Before AI can help your business predict demand, accelerate growth, inform decisions, automate tasks, reveal insights, generate content, you have to trust it. Introducing WatsonX Governance, helping you govern any AI as data, models, and policies change so you can scale it responsibly. Let's create AI that begins with trust with WatsonX Governance. Learn more at ibm.com/governance. IBM, let's create.
The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Hey, everybody.
Welcome back.
Oh, yeah. Very excited to dive right into this one today,
because yeah.
I'm assuming if you're here that you heard part one of our Oppenheimer story. Be weird if you didn't. You just chose to start here.
I mean, I hope so.
Maybe
you're
gonna
feel a little at sea.
Right. Maybe you had an episode randomizer that picked this one for you. Well, go back and listen to part one first. Otherwise, you'll be very lost.
You probably like it better that way. The flow. The flow is better.
Yeah.
Yeah, we wanted to kind of dive into the women in Oppenheimer's life because we saw the movie and it's great. Love it.
Totally.
Fantastic film. Definitely go see it. But as anyone will point out to you, but not just us, but anyone will point out to you, Christopher Nolan, not that great at writing women characters.
Yeah.
And I can see that he made a concerted effort to include some women in this film. And I appreciate that. Hats off to you, sir. But they're still a little sketchy. So kind of wanted to fill in a little more of their personalities and the role they really played in his life besides just Gene was a communist and that made trouble for him.
Yeah.
Katie was a drunk and that made trouble for him. Like, you know, that's not enough for me. I want to know more.
It's a 3-hour movie as it is.
I know.
And there's only so much. But it is, I think we have discussed, it's a common problem that, sure, this movie doesn't have time and shouldn't have to focus on the side characters. I mean, you know, like Josh Hartnett's character doesn't get much more time either.
Right.
But the problem is there aren't any movies out there telling Kitty's story and Gene's story. So,
and sadly, it wouldn't be that interesting of a movie probably because of the kind of limited lives that women were forced to. I mean, that's the thing is that I get frustrated because I'm like, you wouldn't want to necessarily watch a movie about the women of Los Alamos sitting around waiting to not hear from their husbands
you
about
what
they're up to.
I'd watch Greta Gerwig do it.
I would watch Greta Gerwig find a way. She would find a way. She would find a way. But all that to say is, you know, I mean, it's not women's choice that they have the boring part of history.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Like, these ladies were trying to make their own way and do cool things, and they got sidetracked by the way the world was. And that's very frustrating. And it makes me be like, yeah, I hear you. You don't want to hear a movie about it. But that's part of my problem is that you don't want a movie of their lives because of...
Well,
anyway.
And again, I think once we often dig into that history and you unearth as much as you can, you find out there was interesting stuff going on.
Very true.
And you know, either it wasn't well recorded or it just wasn't well thought of for a long time. But I want Greta Gerwig to do a movie about the women of Oppenheimer. And then I want Christopher Nolan to do a Ken spinoff. And I want to see those.
Imagine the Ken spinoff.
Same weekend release date again for both of them.
The time.
Talk about saving Hollywood.
Listen, but what Ken, is it Ken Mento? McKento?
McKento.
He goes backwards.
Ken's time distortion McKento. Experience.
And he's McKento. Got all these tattoos all over him. I would actually buy the Memento Ken.
Like all 100%. These... Oh, yeah, he's got all...
little tattoos all over him.
Say hi to Barbie.
Say hi to Barbie.
He's got it written across his chest upside down
hi,
so he
Barbie.
Can see it when he looks down.
So you can look at it.
All right, all right. Well, we are going to talk about those movies.
Yes, we are.
But first... In the first part of this episode, we're going to finish up the story of Robert Oppenheimer and Kitty, his wife. Mm-hmm. I think we get a little back into Gene again. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, our friend Ruth Tolman. So lots left to tell. Very exciting stuff. And again, if you haven't seen the movie, this, I think, is a little more spoilery than the stuff we mentioned in part one. But yeah.
It was more fun to watch it not knowing.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, seen the movie. Either way, I say we just dive in and get started.
Let's do it.
Hey there, friends, come listen well. Eli and Diana got some stories to tell. There's no matchmaking or romantic tips. It's just about ridiculous relationships. A lover might be any type of person at all. An abstract concept or a concrete wall. But if there's a story worth a second glance, we'll put it in our show, Ridiculous Romance.
A production of iHeartRadio.
So apparently, in her drunkenness, Kitty would get a little graphic about her sex life, and she made comments about how she had to teach Oppenheimer about foreplay and that sex could be fun. He previously was not aware. He was like, oh, I thought it was for science.
It's probably very mechanical.
Yeah.
Science joke. Maybe in his approach. And she was like, hey, we could have a good time with this.
Uh-huh. You put the one in the zero. That's sex. So,
that works too well, honestly. Go ahead.
So Klaus and Straczynski take this information to show that maybe Robert's relationship with Jean Tatlock wasn't really as sexually charged as we've heard it or seen it portrayed in the movie. Because he's just, again, he's not this like passionate sexual guy necessarily until Kitty got her claws in him.
Right. Well, and in the film, when you see Jean, they're either having sex or they just had sex.
Right.
So it's just very, like, if you were just to watch the film and not look at any research, you might think, oh, Robert and Jean were, like, passionate, sexy sex times.
Right.
And he and Kitty were, like, just a good marriage. Like, she was just the right wife for him or something.
Right, right.
But that's not necessarily the case. So, anyway.
So, and here's a little bit about this, just something that I loved in the movie. Even Kitty's detractors, even all the people who talk shit about Kitty, could not deny that when she was called in as a witness in her husband's security clearance hearing, she was his greatest defender. She was total superhero, badass, Mary Poppins, coming in there.
That's right.
Shutting it down. Mm-hmm. The secretary, Verna Hobson, said, quote, so many times I've seen her pull herself together when you didn't believe she possibly could.
That's right.
So despite her being drunk or on pills or whatever, depressed, whatever was going on with her, when she needed to, she stood up and she would kick ass.
That's right.
Probably a lot of people underestimated her for that.
100%
Oh, she's just a drunk. She can't do nothing. And then she's like, hang on a second.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, let me tell you this.
I mean, pretty much.
She talked circles around the investigators. If you saw the movie, you saw this scene. And Kitty impressed all of Robert's friends with her performance.
Right. Like, even people who were like, she's the worst possible wife for him.
Exactly.
I hate her. She sucks. Like, she was a tower of strength during this time.
Yeah.
She was a better witness than Robert.
Right.
Like, they were like, she was the one.
And years later, when Oppenheimer was given his medal and the government was like, oh, sorry, buddy, no hard feelings, right?
Right.
Like, I know we sued you and investigated for treason and all this stuff.
Ruined your reputation.
It's all water under the bridge for us. Even then, she held a damn grudge
until
the end. She wasn't taking that bullshit apology, none of that.
Which makes me think of earlier when the neighbor was like, she's fiercely loyal. She is like a little lion.
Yep.
And I'm like, that's exactly
that's
what I'm seeing. Like, once she decides you're on her team, she will fight for you for until tooth and nail.
Now, after Oppenheimer's security clearance was revoked, their daughter Toni was diagnosed with polio. So they moved to the U.S. Virgin Island of St. John while she recovered. Robert and Kitty ended up discovering a shared love of sailing. So they built a beach house there and they sailed together every summer. So they were like, we used to ride horses. Now we're riding boats.
Now we're riding boats.
Yeah. They're like, whatever. I just want to be on a particular, a very specialized landscape. And whatever thing is best suited to travel that landscape,
yes. I'm into it. I'm in it.
Then they, you know, then they go to Alaska and they're all in snowmobiles all the time.
Snowshoes all
day. Right. They go to Florida and they just can't, they can't get over their shared love of fan boats.
I was just like, they're in bathing suits at the grocery store? I don't know. Where are you going with that?
No, fan no. They're in Australia. They're hopping around in kangaroo pouches.
Amazing. I would do that.
Just like,
if
I didn't
think a kangaroo would immediately kick my face in.
I love a specialized form of transportation in a particular and singular landscape. That's their thing.
Well, that was their new thing. They had some lovely summers together.
Sure.
But on January 6th, 1967, Robert Oppenheimer was diagnosed with inoperable cancer. Mm. And he died a little more than a month later on February 18th.
Yeah.
So it did not take long.
From smoking, I'll add.
Yes.
He was a heavy smoker.
Heavy.
This was, I believe, throat cancer, right?
I think you're right.
Yeah.
I think you're right. Yeah. And per his wishes, Kitty had him cremated and she dropped his urn off the coast of St. John within sight of their beach house. In May of that year, their close friend, Robert Serber, who we've mentioned several times, his wife died by suicide, very tragically.
Yeah.
A few months after that, Robert Serber and Kitty Oppenheimer were living together. So she found her another man, I guess.
Yeah.
And Kitty got him into sailing as well. In 1972, they purchased a boat and they planned to sail through the Panama Canal to Japan.
Oh, wow.
Which sounds amazing.
Yeah.
But Kitty had an embolism and she died on October 27th, 1972. Decadent Review points out in Atomic Love Story, they kind of wrap it up by saying, oh, she found another man close to hand and married him. And Decadent Review is kind of like, that's a little bit of a judgment that's being called about her.
Yeah.
Nobody says after Kitty dies, Robert Serber takes up with a student, like a young woman, like much younger than him. And Decadent Review points out, nobody says, oh, Robert Serber found the closest woman to hand. Like nobody has the same.
Yeah.
Disparagement of him meeting a companion as they do for her. So just to keep in mind that everything we know about Kitty was said in a time when a woman who was very opinionated and outspoken was not maybe a well-respected woman.
Yeah.
People didn't like women like that.
Right.
So everything we read about her now, we read it differently, I think. And so it's harder to kind of jive all these ideas of her together, I think.
Everyone was so conditioned to think that was like abnormal behavior. Like, she's telling people she doesn't like that when you do it. What's wrong with her?
Right. Not obedient.
Lady.
Yeah. Not quiet.
Yeah.
She's not a die away miss.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so.
And that also may have contributed to her being difficult to like. Or
easily.
Being a brusque and mean person, you know, that sort of builds on itself. It's a little self-fulfilling when you say, oh, because she's opinionated, she's so nasty.
Right.
And then she's like, well, then, yeah, I am nasty because everyone thinks I'm so opinionated and they're cruel to me. So, I think it's a vicious spiral to get stuck in.
It is. So it just. You decide. You don't have to like Kitty or anything like that. I'm not sure I would have been friends with her, but but it is something that's interesting to think about just from hindsight, how we read people in their time versus now, you know, kind of stuff like that. But Robert and Kitty did have two children, and I was kind of curious about the kids.
Yeah.
According to nuclearmuseum.com, Tony Oppenheimer never really got along with her mother. She had two unsuccessful marriages, and she was deeply depressed by her father's passing.
Mm.
She was also denied a security clearance to become a translator for the UN.
Oh.
And that kind of brought up a lot of trauma from her dad's security clearance hearing in 54. So she was really depressed, and lots of things going wrong for her when she died by suicide at the beach house in St. John in 1977.
Oh, man. Now, their son, Peter Oppenheimer, did not do well in school. He did really terribly, even though he was very smart.
Mm-hmm.
But he had a lot of anxiety, and he also got teased a lot about his dad, especially after the security hearing. Peter once wrote on the chalkboard in class that, quote, certain people in the U.S. government should go to hell. He's not wrong.
Still
then
true
or
today.
Now, yeah. Apparently, Robert Oppenheimer was told by a family friend that he should get some psychological help for his son for his anxiety when he was a kid. But Robert was offended at this idea because the friend, Pat Scher, said that Oppenheimer, quote, could not have a son who needed help. I think that's one of those masculine pride issues. Yes. Like, no son of mine needs psychological help. He's fine. He's a healthy boy.
What I find so fascinating about this is that Robert Oppenheimer was really interested in psychology.
Yeah.
Gene Tatlock worked with kids in psychiatry. Ruth Tolman was a psychiatrist, a psychologist. He had a lot of respect for that field. But at this time period, of course, if you had to see a therapist, it meant you were a crazy person. Like, you were beyond...
Right.
You were beyond crazy
if
you needed a therapist. So it's just like a really weird, weight to put on therapy
and
at that time.
He, as an intellectual, probably very much thought like, oh, that's for lesser mortals.
Maybe, yeah.
You know, if you, not just like you must be super crazy if you need a therapist, but, well, we're smart. We have control of our brains.
Right.
Because we're so well-educated and well-read. Mm-hmm. Like, we can reason our way out of, which I know a lot of us still think, I think of myself today. Why can't I just think my way out of this psychology problem, you know, and you can't. That's the whole idea, is that it's not something you can't outsmart yourself.
Mm.
But I know, I'm sure that Robert Oppenheimer was very much like a mind over matter person.
True.
And if you're my son, if you're a little Robert Oppenheimer and you're having trouble with your anxiety, here's the formula to get rid of it.
Right. Well, and I wonder, too. Again, time period wise, they're still very Freudian in that all your problems are because of your childhood and your parents.
Yeah,
so I wonder if how much of that was like, I'm not going to send my son to learn about why I was a shitty dad.
Yeah, right.
I already know I'm a shitty dad.
I don't need to pay you $30,000 to tell me that.
I don't need some doctor to tell me I wasn't involved enough in my kid's life. So I probably a number of reasons why that offended him.
Yeah.
But he was definitely like, uh-uh.
Yeah. Peter himself once said, quote, "My father's tragedy was not that he lost his clearance, but my mother's slow descent into alcoholism." Cut that word slow.
Mm. Now, this lends a lot of credence to the drunken.
Yes.
Now, and I was going to say, Robert Serber, throughout this book, American Prometheus, you know, he said, Gene Tatlock, Robert Oppenheimer loved her the most.
Yep.
But, of course, at the time, he had already been with his wife, Kitty.
Kitty, yeah.
So did it not make him feel better to say he loved Gene more than Kitty, so it's okay that I'm with Kitty?
Oh, I see.
I wonder.
I see.
I wonder. I don't know. Speculation station. And then I also wonder if he said, oh, she wasn't that drunk. She just took pills. Like, everybody's so...
Yeah.
But he was with her, you know? He had feelings for her. So he might have been trying to... you know, do a little bit of repair on her image or something out of love, out of affection of Kitty.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he might not be a reliable narrator for who she is.
Well, and it could also be very similar to his son and psychiatry, where he's like, she doesn't know, she's not an alcoholic. We're better than that.
Right.
You know, we're superior to that sort of base human issue that lesser people have. She drinks a lot, but it's something that we're smart enough to get through.
Right.
You know, she's fine.
She's okay.
Yeah.
Right. But anyway, for the fact that Peter said,
yeah,
my mother had a slow descent into alcoholism. You know what? Cut slow. It wasn't slow.
Yeah.
And also Tony, apparently as a kid, was constantly cleaning up after her mother. She would clean up her empty glasses and her beer bottle or whatever. Mm. And that's what kind of caused Tony's rift with her mom, was that she started getting really upset about all that.
Yeah.
And not liking having to do all that and have a drunk mom or whatever.
Right.
So because the kids say it, I kind of believe it.
Yeah, it does. It does feel like
I kind of believe that she was maybe a pretty bad alcoholic. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when it comes to Peter, mostly, according to Nuclear Museum, he has, quote, been so positive about his parents that his children are often taken aback by media portrayals of Kitty Oppenheimer as cruel and unrelenting. So even you know, her grandkids are like, come on, that lady, dad only says the nicest things about her. You know, maybe she was a drunk, but yeah.
Right.
Now, Peter Oppenheimer is now a carpenter, and he lives in total seclusion on Paracaliente. And so we say, let's nobody bother him. You know, he's like 80 something years old.
Okay, leave that man alone.
Leave that man alone.
Hashtag protect Peter.
Yes. He's had it hard enough.
I really think so. And that's what I wonder too for him, if he's like, all right, I have plenty to say about my parents.
Right.
But everyone already said every bad and good thing about them. I don't need to add to it. I'm just going to say they were great, fantastic. Now fuck off. Like, I don't want to talk to you or anyone else.
Yeah, no, for sure. For sure.
I mean,
got to be so tough. He was the most talked about man in the world for a long time.
Yes.
Oppenheimer. And what a shadow to live under.
Right.
Right. I mean, no matter what. And so.
And it makes me sad to think that Peter and Tony, and I don't know if they were close or not, but it seems like they lived pretty separate lives.
Right.
And it makes me sad to think that the only other person in the world who could understand what it was to be Robert Oppenheimer's kid.
Yeah.
They weren't close to.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah,
I feel like that would bring you together, but I don't know. And who knows? Again, we don't know that much about them. They might have been fine together, but
the other thing, and I'll say we've sort of deliberately, I think, not gotten into this conversation too much on this show. But the other thing that can't not be a huge part of their psychology as they become adults and move into the world is knowing that their father created the atomic bomb.
Yeah.
You know, and shortly there, and was, you know, in some linear fashion, directly responsible for the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people, horrific deaths. Mm-hmm. And whatever, there's a whole lot more to say about the merits of that, the reasons for that, and of course, Oppenheimer's involvement, why he was involved, and what he felt afterwards, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
So much to say that we don't need to get into today. I do recommend seeing the movie. Where there's a little more just like, I don't know, it sort of even still leaves that to interpretation. But I'm thinking that can't not be part of their identity as well, his kids.
Mm-hmm. Has to be.
Yeah. My dad's the guy who made the nuke.
Especially after all of the photos of what happened in Japan.
Yes.
And what really that weapon wrought.
Yeah.
After you see that, how do you not have that connected to your father forever? I mean... Or do you? I don't know. You know, like, because you know your dad is your dad. It's a very specific character in your life.
Right.
So who he is to other people is kind of separate. You're like, who's that guy? You know what I mean? Like, I've felt that way about my dad sometimes. I'm like, oh, they know somebody different than I know.
Yeah,
you know what
definitely.
I'm saying?
Definitely.
And that's just how it is. But, like, you know, it must be really hard to reconcile. Just mm-hmm. And I think that was what was so great about the movie was kind of showing how much everybody wanted him to do this project. They wanted this. They asked him for it. They were begging him for it. They were pressuring him for it. But then once it happened, nobody really wanted to take responsibility for those consequences and be attached to that literal outcome. It really is. I don't know. It's really hard. We could argue for hours and hours about whether or not it was right to make it.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's a very fascinating topic, and the movie will make you feel it. That's the truth.
And speaking of the movie, I think we've said everything that we can say at this point about Robert Oppenheimer's life and his three, the main three women that he interacted with romantically, that really had an impact on him as a person. So I'm very excited that we get to uncover all that.
I was so happy to do a deep dive into all their lives. They were very fascinating women. You can see why he was attracted to them. They were smart and they had a quick wit about them.
Right.
And,
right.
you know, they could hold their own with Robert Oppenheimer. Mm-hmm. And I think that says a lot.
And for all his problems, he wasn't a big piece of shit.
No, not an overwhelming piece of shit or anything.
I mean, we're talking about the time period.
I know. Well, there's some stories where, like, he invited, like, a young female student over to his house with Kitty at some point, and, you know, he's trying to entrance this girl, so he's kind of saying cutting things about his wife.
Oh.
So there's, like, some anecdotes like that. It's nothing so insane that you'd be like, what a monster, you know what I mean? But, like, it's just 50s husband shit, mm-hmm. you know? Like, I'm just kind of, I don't, there was a little bit, too, with Robert where I still admire him in some ways. And I like that he was attracted to women who were very strong and smart and had mm-hmm. a lot of personality mm-hmm. and character. But he's also kind of one of those guys who's very attracted to that. And then once he's got them, he kind of wants to stamp out those things about them.
Right, right.
Because
he's
like, you're supposed to do something else now that you're married to me or now that you're, you know what I mean? Like, I'm not trying to say he's like, don't work or something.
Right.
But he just had an idea about how it was supposed to be and he didn't have any problem with the way it worked. But So these ladies are fully oppressed by their lives, and he's not really recognizing that.
We've come across that a lot in our history shows sometimes, where it's just, you know, we realize that these people were just as much victims of the culture. Like, you know, he had it embedded in his head as well. It's like, well, once you're married, you know, men act a certain way, women act a certain way, you know, and it's that same just perpetual systemic issue that everyone's sort of born into. And I almost wish that if I could go back in time and shake Robert Oppenheimer, if I could change one thing Robert Oppenheimer did, it'd be to let him understand that he could be married to an intelligent woman who's his equal.
Right.
You know,
right.
That'd be the one thing I would change about all the things in Robert Oppenheimer's life.
Wow. Wow.
Like, I don't want to go stepping on butterflies here.
Mm.
So.
Well, and I think, too, this is such an interesting, like, this Berkeley enclave of, like, kind of rich, very intellectual, sort of superior kind of academics that are all fucking each other's wives and stuff. Like, they're, you know, it's something very similar to Belle Epoque or, you know, any of these other periods of time where it's, like, all these people are together and they kind of aren't, the marriage vow is sort of, you know, so it's even weirder that it's like you maybe view marriage as like who's a good partner for me rather than whom I'm in love with and passionate about or something. I can get that anytime.
Yeah.
But like who is a good partner for me?
Sure.
And I'm not sure he ever really picked a good partner for him, quote unquote.
That's true.
And people certainly had their opinions about Kitty being good or bad, you know, depending on which part of the story you're in.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Saved his ass sometimes.
She saved his ass, and sometimes she was kind of, you know, a bit of a distraction.
Yeah, a challenge.
So,
yeah.
You know, but again, it's you can't divorce that from how they felt about living their lives.
Yeah.
I mean, fully, Jean committed suicide. I don't think it had that much to do with Robert.
No.
You know, it had a lot to do with everything else.
Right.
You know, it was. Or she was murdered, obviously, by a Jagger.
Well, if you ask me.
But I could see her being, if she was already that depressed, if she was feeling that constrained.
Right.
Not that unusual. I mean, Kitty's drinking problem probably had a lot to do with that feeling, too. It's just another way to kill yourself, right? Just more slowly. I don't know.
Well.
Ruth's the only one who fucking handled her shit.
She got out. She did all right.
Ruth handled it.
All right. Well, okay. We talked about this story, and there's more to talk about because, of course, we double featured, not the same day, but the same weekend, we saw Barbie and Oppenheimer.
Yes.
Now, we're going to take a little break and we're going to come back and just the rest of the episode, we're going to talk about those two movies. We'll start with Oppenheimer since we just learned his life and then move on to Barbie. But we just had such a good time and I think such an interesting time watching both that we've got a lot to say.
I know, right? Yeah, we could talk about those movies forever.
Yeah. So let's talk about those movies forever.
Forever.
Right after this commercial break. We'll be right back.
Before AI can help your business predict demand, accelerate growth, inform decisions, automate tasks, reveal insights, generate content, you have to trust it. Introducing Watson X Governance, helping you govern any AI as data, models, and policies change so you can scale it responsibly. Let's create AI that begins with trust with Watson X Governance. Learn more at ibm.com/governance. IBM, let's create.
LASIK. LASIK.com.
Have you been thinking about LASIK but not sure if you're a candidate? Just go to LASIK.com/quiz and take our free candidacy quiz. In just a few minutes, you'll know if LASIK is likely right for you. And if it is, we'll connect you with experienced LASIK doctors in your area. Start your journey towards 20/20 vision. Take our free candidacy quiz at LASIK.com/quiz. Yeah, LASIK.com. Easy to remember, so you know where to start.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
A new season of Bridgerton is here. And with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabrielle Collins, and this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Colin Bridgerton has returned from his travels abroad. Is betrothal written in the stars for the eligible bachelor? Meanwhile, the ton is reverberating with speculation of who holds Lady Whistledown's pen. We're discussing it all. I sit down with Nicola Coughlin, Luke Newton, Shonda Rhimes, and more to offer an exclusive peek behind the scenes of each episode of the new season. Watch season 3 of the Shondaland series on Netflix. Then, fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to catch a new episode every Thursday.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh, my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And, of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, welcome back to the show, everybody.
You want to talk about Barbie and Oppenheimer, the double feature of the year.
The biggest double feature of the year. The two movies that saved the box office this month. There's always this one month, that saves the box office every once in a while. Yeah, but we saw both. We saw Barbie first, then we saw Oppenheimer again. Mm-hmm. 70mm IMAX, big, huge, beautiful screen.
Yep.
Since we just learned about Oppenheimer, let's start there.
Okay.
Okay, first of all, I'll give you my Nolan background, because I know a lot of people, fellas especially, who start talking about Christopher Nolan movies can get a little into it.
Mm-hmm.
And I love Christopher Nolan movies. I really do. The Prestige and Dunkirk are Dunkirk among two of my favorite of his movies. Gripping. They're so good. I'll say it. You know what? I'll say it.
Okay.
I love Nolan's Batman trilogy.
Uh-huh.
And The Dark Knight it's great. It's perfectly great.
Oh,
I think
we just got 1,000
messages. No, hang on. It's so good. I think when you pull Heath Ledger's performance out of it and just look at it, you know, there's a couple of messy parts is all I'm saying. There's some stuff that doesn't make sense, and I think morally it's a little ambiguous and kind of wants to have its cake and eat it too.
Sure.
Personally, I think Batman Begins is my favorite of the trilogy. It's so good.
Yeah.
But we're not here to talk about Batman. We're here to talk about Oppenheimer. It's very Nolan in terms of its direction. Mm-hmm. It clips along. Mm-hmm. I love the way that his scenes don't end. They just bleed right into each other. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a big part because of the music.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't cut at the end of a scene. It keeps playing right into the next one.
Yep.
It's almost montage-y.
Mm-hmm.
This, for a historical biopic, this movie moves fast.
Yep.
And that's what I was saying earlier about the IMAX, where I'm like, it was almost too big for me to really dial in on what was being said and the story that was happening. That I'm so glad we saw it there because it was beautiful, but I kind of want to watch it on my phone at a certain point, right? Just be like, zero distractions, blinders on. Like, let me only just look at this tiny little screen and hear what they're saying.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Which he doesn't like you to hear what they're saying all the time. Given the sound mixing we get sometimes from a Nolan film. I will say he doesn't do biopics really. Is this his only biopic?
This is his, I think it's his only biopic. It's his, as far as I know, second nonfiction after Dunkirk.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Everything else has been sort of sci-fi or, you know, some sort of pseudo fantasy like The Prestige or something, which is kind of sci-fi too.
Yeah, I guess it was.
Yeah.
Well, I did really like that he did this one, particularly because of his little weird shit. He likes to play with timelines.
Yeah.
That, you know, he always does that in his movies in one way or another.
Yeah.
Either it's going backwards or whatever. And in this one, you know, he's showing you the security hearing. He's showing you Louis Strauss's confirmation hearing.
Right.
And then also, of course, the atomic project in the 40s.
Right.
So you're kind of flipping between all of these different timelines and different periods in this man's life. And what worked about it for me is that, you know, you're kind of starting off at the security hearing and they're all like, well, let's look at this piece of shit that made the atomic bomb. Like, how, you know, you're this communist lover. And they're really mean to him in the security hearing.
Yeah.
And then the next scene, or as you say, the next kind of part of the montage, it sort of bleeds directly into the next scene. Somebody going, you're the man to do this. And you have to. You're going to save the world.
Oh, my God.
You have to defeat Nazi Germany. You know, like they are really laying on him for this project. So I think it really does a good job at putting you in his headspace or his, I guess, Christopher Nolan's idea of what his headspace must have been, where he's like, I'm remembering very nearby in my mind was y'all begging me to do this.
Yeah.
And now you're really pissed at me for doing it.
Right.
And I can't, I am too, you know, but like, I can't, I don't know how to respond to this. And it's very frustrating and contradictory and very scapegoaty feeling.
Yeah.
Which, of course, it's exactly what he was. So I think he does a really good job of kind of putting you in that mind space, that psychological space.
Totally. And I think that's kind of what the movie is mostly all about. Because, again, I don't think the movie is here to answer these big questions. Was it a good idea for the bomb?
Yeah.
Was it the right thing to do in terms of, you know, the argument, of course, the largest argument is, by dropping the two A-bombs on Japan, we stopped a land war that would have claimed many millions of lives.
Mm-hmm.
But look where we are now, which of course is kind of sort of at the end of the movie too. What was the long-term damage? Is that worth it? But instead of trying to answer those questions, the movie's much more like, well, let's just look at this guy and what might it have been like to be him? What might it have been like to be the guy who did that? How do you sit with that? How do you live with that afterwards?
Yeah.
And then also at the same time, like you said, the very people who were begging you to do it have now turned around and said, how dare you, sir?
How could you have done that?
What a monster you must be.
Crazy.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating too, the element of security that you're talking about a little earlier with in terms of Russia was our ally.
Yeah.
But everybody knew at some point this war is going to end and they're not going to be our ally anymore.
Right.
Like it's not a question, you know?
Right.
And so all of that kind of hiding and fear from our own allies was a real problem.
Oof.
Of course, you still had German scientists involved that was, you know, literally, I think he even says in the movie, anti-Semitism is our best bet, because we can go get all these great German scientists that are Jewish that are not allowed
to
work for Hitler, basically.
Yeah.
That Hitler's like, purge these guys. So he's like, let's go get them and make them work for us.
Oppenheimer himself is Jewish. I don't think we mentioned that.
That's right. He was Jewish. I don't think he was a practicing.
No,
he's
no.
He's very religious, but he was Jewish. But there was still a lot of feeling that like, oh, well, it doesn't matter if Hitler sucks and you know he sucks and you're very mad right now at your home, still your home country. And there's going to be that feeling and you're going to want to help your home country and not me.
Can
the
I trust
US.
You? Yeah.
So I don't know. You know, there's a lot of that kind of like, again, distrust. I mean, straight up restraint, you know, amongst all relationships. You had to be really careful. And it's kind of a foreign feeling to me because the big war of our time, of course, is the war of Iraq. And, you know, we could not be more distant from that war. There is no...
The propaganda of the Iraq war was, don't even worry about it, guys.
Uh-huh. We got it.
We got this over here. You know, support the troops.
Uh-huh.
Put the yellow ribbon on your car.
Buy stuff
and
for the terrorists win. Yeah.
And that's all you need to do. And not the World War II mentality of, we're all in this together.
Mm-hmm.
Sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're going to feel it at home when we go off to war. And you dealing with that is you supporting your country.
Right.
So different.
Or even the sense of you know, you're in the middle of you live in a small town in Maryland or something. But people are still like, loose lips sink ships. Like, you can't be talking about stuff you hear on the news.
Right.
Because you don't know who you're talking to and who they're going to tell and what they're going to say. And it was just a lot of this like fear of spies listening and... You know, it's just such a, I didn't hear, I guess because we already had computers and they were like, everybody already knows everything
everybody
you
knows
say.
Everything. Yeah.
I don't have to tap your phone or whatever. You're telling me everything through Alexa or whatever. But anyway, it's just so weird to think about. It was such a different paranoid time.
Man.
And you get caught up in that shit and it changes your behavior a lot.
That was one of the things that was most interesting about it to me. You know, I as the movie's coming closer to coming out, all these little YouTube videos are popping up. It's like, the life of Robert Oppenheimer. Here's why Oppenheimer's interesting. Here's what you need to know. And I literally knew practically nothing about him and wanted to go into the movie with that.
Yeah.
I was like, the movie, I want to be totally surprised by everything that happens here. And I was. Mm-hmm. And maybe had a hard time following some parts of it, where I just had to double back on the conversations.
Right.
But it was so interesting to see that paranoia and how it affected everyone and the eggshells everybody's on all the time and the challenges of not just, you know, A, they've got these time limits, which I also didn't know either. It was like the space race. Mm-hmm. Like, Russia's actually further ahead. They've done things we haven't done yet, and we're going to watch that and copy it and try and leapfrog what their work. That's exactly what happened with the space race. Russia was in space first.
Oh, yeah.
And we leapfrogged that to get to the moon. So that was really fascinating to me. But then on top of that, just the fact that while you're under this immense pressure, you can't talk to anyone. You can't call your friends. You can't even, you have to live in our fake little town we built. Mm-hmm. Just a nightmare, I think, to be living in that time.
Well, and and we see this in the movie, a lot of complaints amongst the scientists who feel that knowledge is global and they shouldn't have to hide their discoveries from their Russian or German or Swiss or whatever
colleagues that they had spent time with, that they know personally.
I respect this person. I learned from them. I used their equations in my shit or whatever.
Right.
And so they felt very strongly that, like, I should be able to share these things.
Yeah.
And in addition to that, they're not sharing with me.
Right.
So I'm behind maybe what they know, and that's putting me at a disadvantage of my science. Just pure science. I'm angry that I'm not able to get the resources that are out there and exchange these thoughts with these other brilliant people, where I know in these discussions we're both going to see things or come up with things that we wouldn't have come up with on our own.
Yeah, totally.
So it's like slowing me down. I feel really frustrated, you know, but it was also a bit of a hint. When scientific community stopped sharing nuclear information, it was a hint to every security department worldwide that, they're working on a bomb. They stopped sharing.
Yep.
Now I know they're working on that shit.
Yep.
Like, it was a clue. So you had to be really careful.
And have we ever come back from that? I mean, the international community, I don't know what it was like before.
Right.
But it still feels like the same thing now. Like, no, you can't trust anybody or share anything with anyone else. I know we're all just people trying to live on this stupid spinning marble together, but that person's slightly different than me. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that means they're going to stab me in the back the first chance they get. It's wild, that kind of distrust. And you see that in the movie as well.
Yeah.
I was also really fascinated by that there was people saying, like you said, we've got to share information with each other. In fact, a lot of people, of course, thought the whole point of the A-bomb is once they know we've built it, they'll stop. There's no more war.
That's right.
Because who would get involved? I'm not even going to build one once you have one, which is obviously a little arrogant to think. And of course, has time and again proven untrue. There's Dr. Seuss Butter Battle Book, right? There is no weapon big enough to stop everyone from using weapons.
Right. Or decide we don't want one of our own.
Yeah.
You shouldn't get to press that button that destroys everything. I get to press that button.
Yep.
You know,
it's a pain in the ass. I would love to talk about performances in this movie because I think at the center of it all, it is the cast. And you know what? I'll say it. Also, I'll say this. I was a fan of Cillian Murphy before it was cool.
Oh.
Look, I'm just saying.
Tastemaker Eli in the house.
28 Days Later comes out.
Right.
There's going to be people out there who are like, yeah, he was in stuff before that, you loser. but 28 Days Later came out, and I was obsessed with that movie.
Yeah.
I was like, I'm not into zombie movies, even though 28 Days Later is not a zombie movie also. because they don't die. It's not about it's not about the living dead. In 28 Days Later, it's just a rage virus.
Oh, yeah.
So technically, if I push my glasses up on my nose here, it's not a zombie movie. But anyway, I was like, this guy is amazing and I want to watch everything that he's in.
Yeah.
And at the time I was like, have you guys heard of Cillian Murphy? Because he's so cool. And then learned like 5 years later that it's pronounced Killian. But
Cillian Murphy. Silly old Murphy.
Silly old Murphy. Here's a little factoid for you all that blew my damn mind, even as a Cillian Murphy fan. Robert Oppenheimer was tall.
Yeah. Tall, Cillian Murphy. Slim, everyone
says. I have always thought that Cillian Murphy was tall and slim. That man is 5'7". And there's nothing wrong with that. But he has a very towering presence. And he's actually shorter than my short ass.
That's right.
At 5'9". So, short king Cillian Murphy.
Short king Cillian Murphy.
Yeah. Incredible. That's probably the most mind-blowing. That's probably the most explosive piece of information that I got out of Oppenheimer.
The most important thing I learned.
Because there's times where they shoot it. We talked about this. There's times where they shoot it and he looks like the tallest guy in the room.
Yep.
And there's times where they shoot it and he looks like everyone is like imposing on him.
Yep.
And he's surrounded by giants.
Beautifully done.
So good.
Because it's so much. I think really he was really trying to put us in his brain, his perspective. It's not meant to be an overarching perspective of nuclear whatever.
Right.
It's literally this guy and what he thought and felt during this time.
Yeah.
And these various times in his life. And I thought that camera work worked beautifully for that, because when he felt confident, he was the biggest guy in the room. And when he felt like he was getting piled on, he was the smallest.
Yeah.
It was beautifully shown in that way. And I will say, I thought Cillian Murphy and Christopher Nolan did something that's very hard to do with a biopic, in that they did not make him a hero or a villain.
Yeah.
I think that's so hard to do. If usually with a biopic, you kind of pick a side.
You're right.
And you're like, I've decided that this person's the protagonist. So anyway, they're the hero and everything they did was right and fine and whatever. And like, you might have feelings, but anyway, in this movie, they were right to do it. And it's all great. But in this case, I really think they left it. I think they both felt ambivalent about it in a way. And they were like, this was just a human guy who was in the middle of history and happened to be the finger of destiny was placed on him.
Oh,
like, it didn't have to be him.
Right.
It was weird that it was him.
Yeah.
People were like, General Groves chose probably the worst guy in the world for it because he had all these communist ties and he was a lefty and he, you know, like, he wasn't the most brilliant nuclear scientist there was.
He wasn't good at math.
He's terrible at math. He was bad at lab. He was a theorist.
Yeah.
And so a lot of people were like, that's a weird choice. But as you said, he was like, this guy's magnetic. People are going to follow him.
Yeah.
And that's what I need.
Yeah.
And in the movie, Oppenheimer says, I think you chose me because of my lefty association so you can control me.
Right.
And I don't think he was wrong about that either.
Yeah.
I'm sure he saw it as leverage sometimes.
Right.
But anyway, I thought they both did that really well in the writing and the performance, of kind of being like, this is a complicated individual. He's not always right and he's not always wrong.
Right.
He's not a villain and he's not a hero. He was a guy. You know, he's just a guy. And I think that's really hard to do.
That's so interesting.
I was impressed by that.
Yeah, that you say that. I'm thinking about actors often who play, you know, wicked characters in some way, shape, or form. And the thing you say is, well, I can't think they're evil. I have to think that. I have to think like they do, that my behavior is justified and I take these actions because I think they're right. So I have to think of myself as the hero or the good guy or something. But this is Cillian Murphy is playing a guy who literally is questioning his own morals.
Yes.
Am I a villain?
Am I
a horrible person? Or did I do the right thing? Mm-hmm. I'm literally hearing it from all sides and I don't know myself.
Right.
So I think that's where that comes from in this movie, where it is able to balance that so well, is probably both of them not approaching this character as someone who thinks he's doing the right thing, but quite the opposite, a character who has absolutely no idea if he's done the right thing or not.
Right. And also beautifully shot was his congratulations, everyone, it worked. And we dropped the bomb and it worked. And he had to give this speech. And I thought that was really well done, because he had such a, and of course he had his own personal, like, fuck, I didn't know it was going to kill this many people. I didn't realize, you know, exactly the weight or the destruction, the destructive power it would have.
Right.
I knew it would be big, but more people than I thought, whatever.
Yeah.
Also, he's looking at people who spent years with him building this bomb, and they're proud of their achievement.
Yeah.
And they should be proud of it. And he is proud of it. And he's like, I just wish we could have dropped it on the Nazis, because that's who the fuck I was working against. I didn't really give a shit about Japan.
Yeah.
You know, so anyway, it was just really well done to show him kind of being like jovial and excited in his performance. Like, great job, everybody. Mm-hmm. You did it. Like, ooh, pat yourself on the back. We, you know, it's not just about me. It's about you. Everybody's so great, whatever. And in his mind, he is freaking out. Like, he is seeing the effects of this bomb and like not knowing, am I proud of this? Is this good? I don't know anymore.
I don't know. I think that it's, I want to get back to the performances, but just you saying that makes me think about this element of the movie of we should, I wish we'd dropped it on the Nazis.
Yeah.
Right. I think very deliberately in this movie, the word Japan never comes up once until they say it's the target for the bomb.
That's right.
And I think that must have been so true of the mentality at the time. Like, wait, Japan, what? I thought the whole thing was the Nazis. That's kind of what we've been thinking on. But I think that the scientists themselves, Oppenheimer himself and all his team, at this point, they're so seduced by their own creation, right? That they you get this to this point where you're like, I just have to see if I did it. I just have to know if we succeeded and if it works. And I just have, I built the toy, now I have to use it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so even they are in the moment excited about like, well, just drop it somewhere.
Right.
And so the US has, and again, there's a whole lot of history here to unpack in terms of would Japan, a lot of strategists say Japan never would have surrendered.
I also heard that they sued for peace before the bomb was ever dropped.
Exactly. Obviously, a big part of the movie, too. But they so badly wanted to use it because they could. Mm-hmm. And so this idea of Japan not even coming up until they're a target, I think really speaks to, I sort of said this, but the mentality at the time of just, oh, crap, the Nazis are surrendering. Mm-hmm. Well, we got to do this somewhere. We got to show the world. We got to show Russia. Mm-hmm. Was a big part
that
of it
was
too.
The main thing.
What we can do.
Yep.
And they said the first bomb is to show them we can do it. The second bomb is to show them that we can keep doing it.
Yeah.
Horrible. Horrible.
And I guess they didn't really know the effects that the radiation would have, the extra deaths that happened from the radiation, or maybe they did.
We had Kitty studying the effects of radiation on the blood, and so I know that there was an understanding that radiation was deadly afterwards too, but I don't know. And I mean, they were how many miles away from the test site?
Trinity? Oppenheimer and the scientists were 20 miles away.
20 miles away. So they knew there was not just the blast to worry about.
Right.
But fallout.
Other shit. Yeah. Right. Yes. Very true. And,
yeah.
And we'll throw out there that there are a lot of indigenous and people of native New Mexico,
yeah,
who are called downwinders, who,
yeah,
were downwind of the Trinity test and have radiation poisoning from it.
Yeah. And
they have not been recompensed by the government in any way. So they have still, to this day, within their community, birth defects,
mm-hmm,
all kinds of crazy shit from the Trinity test itself.
Right.
So there's, not only in Japan was there fallout from Robert Oppenheimer's and his team's invention, but also right here in America.
Yeah.
And people are still trying to get justice for that.
Yeah. And again, the movie does not go into this thing.
No.
Much like it doesn't go to the women of his life. And there's a degree to which I forgive the movie for that, because it is a singularly focused story. And I don't want Christopher Nolan to be the one who comes out and says, you know, let me tell you about what happened to the Native Americans out here. You know, like, it's not necessarily, he's not going to necessarily do a good job at that.
Very true.
He's telling the Oppenheimer story. I think the issue is that we're going to keep seeing movies like Oppenheimer. Who's going to make one that shows
about
us
the downwinders,
about the downwinders, or about these three women?
That's right.
You know, that just should also exist in tandem. And then we've got the full picture.
Right. Speaking of performances, I will say Everyone says, and everyone knows, Christopher Nolan, quote, doesn't do women. He's not great at writing women.
He's not.
He very rarely has them in his movies. If they're there, they're very limited.
It's often like a very important character with very little screen time. They're like, their significance to the heroes matters so much. They're the only ones with any sense who know what's going on. Like, I'm thinking of Scarlett Johansson in The Prestige, for example.
Right.
But at the same time, the story is not revolve around them.
I think the criticism is that all his female characters only exist in relation to the men.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
What they're doing, and in the same in Oppenheimer.
Yeah.
Jean's whole character is that she was a communist and that was a problem for him.
Yeah.
you know, Kitty's whole character, she's a drunk and that's a problem for him.
Right.
You know, Ruth's whole character is that he was fucking her and that was it. Like, you know, however they related to him, that was it. They had no life outside of that.
Right, right, right.
And again, this is a very focused movie and it makes sense in a way to say, well, how did they, what was their thing with him specifically? Because I don't have time to go follow Jean through her regular daily routine.
Right.
While I'm trying to tell you about the nuclear bomb, you know, I totally, totally get that.
Uh-huh.
It's just, I think what's strange in this film is that he's clearly trying to address it a little bit. He got two amazing actresses, Florence Pugh and Emily Blunt, to play these women. And he there's some scenes, you know, he tried.
Yeah.
I'm like, you tried. But but it's still so lacking. And like particularly Florence Pugh is such a phenomenal actress. And I felt like she didn't really have that much to do with Jean. Jean's scenes seem to be the same thing each time.
Yeah,
she didn't have a lot of levels.
Yeah. That's fair.
And
yeah.
sort of the same with Kitty. She's kind of the same every scene. She was drunk and mad in every scene. And so it was just kind of, where was the softness? I wanted to see what he fell in love with and what they liked about him or, you know, anything that made them more of a person instead of this is who he, this is just the part they had to play in his life to make him who he was.
Yeah.
Instead of this is a full person who affected him, you know?
We have long known that me and Emily Blunt have a very special thing.
I know.
You and I know this. I'm pretty sure John Krasinski knows about it. But Emily Blunt and I have a very special thing between us. Not unlike Oppenheimer and maybe Gene, where it's like, we're both married. We're both happily with our... But, you know, but we can't not be in each other's lives. So a big point being, I'm a big Emily Blunt fan. I think she's very talented. Mm-hmm. And I think she was very good in this movie.
Yes.
But at the same time, I did feel in the moment, and I do want to see it again and re-examine this, but I felt in the moment like her shutting down the interview, her, Rob, what's his name? The Jason Clark's character.
Yes. The security hearing
and her like absolutely destroying him was so well delivered. She did such a good job in that scene. Mm-hmm. And yet it felt unearned because like, he comes, what does Oppenheimer say is like, or is said about her? Like she's always.
He says what Verna Hobson says, basically.
Right.
He's like, you don't know our relationship. She's my wife. We've been through fire together.
We've been through fire
and
together.
And she can pull herself together when you wouldn't think she could. Or
and
some
that,
stuff.
But specifically that part, we've been through fire together.
Right.
In the moment, I was like, oh, have you? We haven't really seen that. There's that one scene where he was sad about Jean's suicide. And she walks up to him and says, pull yourself together.
Right.
And that's even what they flash back to as he's saying, we've been through fire together. And I just felt like the movie lacked, kind of like you said, where is the passion in their relationship that led to this moment where she said, I'm going to put my flask down and destroy all you guys for having the audacity to come after my man, who's one of the best people I know. Like we see a few scenes of her saying, we need to fight harder. We need to fight harder. But I was so taken aback by that sudden turn from her that I felt like it was kind of out of nowhere as opposed to being suggested, and then revealed.
I feel like she was so scornful and almost contemptuous of him in those moments where we need to fight.
Yeah.
That it didn't read as, you know, we're just a different personality from each other and I'm angry on your behalf. It was like, I'm angry at you.
Right, right.
And a lot of the movie was her being angry at him.
Yeah.
She's mad she has a kid. She's mad she doesn't know about this. She's mad about even the thing about pull yourself together. Like, I guess that was something he needed from her was for her to be that kind of person. It's like, hey, I get it. Right. You're sad, but you need to get it together. You're in the middle of something right now.
Yeah.
But it was presented as, look at this shrew. Like every time you saw her, she was kind of a shrew.
Yeah.
And she was just sort of yelling and, I don't know, distracting and not a good presence. And I was like, I don't see what makes her such a great partner for him.
Right.
I don't understand. And as you say, when she does end up being a badass, you're like, where did that even fucking come from?
Yeah.
So, it
was jarring.
It was a little uneven in those ways. I do wish that. It maybe even in the scene where they got together, there was a little more anything there. I don't know. And then they just show him like riding horses. And I guess that's supposed to be the good times.
Oh, those horse scenes, though. God,
they're pretty, gorgeous. But they don't give you much character development.
Yeah.
So, yes. Although, as you say, I did love how she performed that. security hearing scene was really beautifully done. And I will say, too, learning that Kitty did hold a grudge for the rest of her life against every single person who said a damn thing against him, including Edward Teller. When he gets his medal, he goes to shake his hand. And Robert's like, sure, no hard feelings. But Emily Blunt's sitting there fucking glaring at him. Daggers.
Hell no.
And that's clearly very true to life. She was she straight up would have seen Edward and been like, why don't you eat my instead?
Yeah, she said that to Robert's like, how dare you? What do you mean you shook his hand?
Yeah.
Is the guy just sold you out?
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So that was very well done. And I think Emily Blunt said she had she deeply felt for this woman who was very sad and lonely.
Yeah.
And she drank a lot to address those feelings and stuff like that. So
where I think, you know, obviously we can say that Nolan, it's not his strongest storytelling element, right?
Right.
His romances and women and how they women and anything about them.
anything about them.
But and on top of that, this is an incredibly complicated person who made for an incredibly complicated character.
Yeah.
So these things that we're not seeing, not getting, you know, might just be wrapped up in her complications.
Right.
And I do agree that there's probably some things in the movie that could have established something that had a better payoff in that moment. But yeah, it's real hard to encapsulate somebody like Kitty without her own damn movie, which quite frankly, give me that Emily Blunt spinoff and I'm first
I'll watch.
I'll do the 70mm IMAX thing.
I would do that.
Emily Blunt, the better. I've always said.
There is actually a fun story about Kitty on Los Alamos where she fucking was like, why don't you eat shit with your security protocol? Got in the car, drove away from Los Alamos and went to a hotel bar for the night.
Oh, damn.
So there were times she was just like, awesome. Why don't you just eat my dirt? So she actually might be kind of a fun movie, actually, if you really, really wanted to try to pull down this character who is vivacious and lively and sharp tongued. Like a witty person can often be very sharp, as we've learned with like Oscar Wilde, for example. He was kind of a bitch, like, but he was, but that's what his witty. He was a bitchy, witty guy.
Yeah.
And so when he said something, you're like, oh, that shit was funny,
right.
But it was totally a roaster. She might have been a roaster, you know, in that way. But you don't appreciate a female to roast the same way you appreciate a male to roast. You know what I'm saying? As little as you appreciate a male roast in you, you know, you definitely women are supposed to be nice and kind, right? So and whatever. So. At any rate, fantastic performances, even with very little to work with,
right.
I will say. Because again, Florence Pugh.
I mean, forget it.
Amazing.
Florence Pugh, she's doing incredible things
out there.
Very
magnetic.
I've had my foot on the brake with Florence Pugh, like ready to tap it, you know, ever since she sort of popped up. But I've been like, oh, she's, you know, the new hot thing. We'll see. I'm always skeptical of public opinion because I just think everyone's wrong but me. So I don't know what I'm getting at here. Point is, she has consistently amazed me and checked my hesitations numerous times because she's always good.
She is.
She's always very good.
Killer. And as you say, Cillian Murphy, amazing. Just did a fantastic job.
I want to rush to our Barbie review. Mm-hmm. So real quick, we've talked about the movie a lot. Let's just hammer down a couple performances real quick. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we talked about the big three.
Right.
But let's talk Robert Downey Jr. coming in and reminding us why he's one of the greats.
He
absolutely
was
crushed it.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
There were so many moments where he just did something so subtle.
Oh, my God.
Just something so little. And I was like, you just gave me so much in that little moment. And I admire it so much. Like when he said, oh, you were just a lowly shoe salesman.
Uh-huh.
And Louis Strauss goes, just a shoe salesman.
Just a shoe salesman.
And he's smiling, but his eyes are fucking furious.
Yeah.
Like, he just does it. It's such a little moment, but it was so good. And there was a few of those.
The way he pronounces his plosives in that movie, like his P's and B's were different. I know Robert Downey Jr.'s voice pretty well after 12 years of MCU. And he was speaking just this with this subtle difference that was just like, you're embodying a different person right now. And I was so amazed by that.
Yes, he was really great.
And may I say, where the hell has Josh Hartnett been all this time?
Listen, I was so excited.
Oh my God.
He looks different.
He
looks great to me, but he looks different than when he was pretty boy younger or whatever. But I thought he did a fantastic job.
So good. So good. I was just like, I never knew what to think about him.
No, exactly.
He's all over the place. I was like, oh, he's your bestie. He's right there with you. Wait a minute. No, this guy's a fascist. Wait a minute. No, he's got your back. It's just all over the place, yeah. Like in a really good way.
Yeah, he was, his character was apparently, he was really against union organizing.
Yeah.
So that's what was his big problem.
Yeah.
But, and of course, communist. He was surely communist, yeah. Like, kind of guy. But I didn't really get the impression from the movie that he had a long list of grievances and would be spreading rumors about Oppenheimer and stuff.
Yeah.
That was kind of a surprise to see about Ernest Lawrence and the research.
I did kind of get that impression a little bit.
You did?
I did. Yeah, I felt like he, not unlike Strauss, was like he was a little more side by side with Oppenheimer so much that he sort of had a positive working relationship with him. Mm-hmm. But it felt like there was something in there that was like, God, but. Ooh, I just can't wait to punch this guy in the face, though, too.
Right on.
Like, I think he was a little jealous of Oppenheimer.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was resentful of his success, despite the fact that he was like, but I'm meeting with government people about what a problem you are.
Right.
And they gave you the Manhattan Project.
Yeah.
So I thought there was, I picked up elements of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For sure.
Well, anyway, but Josh Hartnett, great job.
Great job, Josh Hartnett.
I think at one point you leaned over and you're like, every white man with a SAG card is in this movie.
In this movie.
And that is so true.
And the rest of SAG was next door working on Barbie. Which brings us to the other movie we saw this past weekend. And we will take our last break for this episode. And we'll come back right after this and talk all about Greta Gerwig's incredibly pink movie. Barbie.
The pinkest movie ever.
Yeah. You know, and of course, goes without saying, we're talking about the movie here, so spoiler alert.
Yeah.
Right?
100% spoilers.
Yeah. We'll be right back.
What if AI could help your business deliver mission-critical outcomes with speed? With IBM Consulting, your business can design, build, and scale trusted AI using Watson X, and modernize the way you work to accelerate real impact. Let's create AI that transforms your business. Learn more at ibm.com/consulting. IBM. Let's create.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
Have a ton of questions about LASIK? You're not alone. That's why we created LASIK.com. One place where you can go to find every answer to every question on your mind. Like, how much does LASIK cost? How long does recovery take? How do I find a doctor? If you've been thinking about LASIK, go to LASIK.com now. Yeah, LASIK.com. Easy to remember, so you know where to start.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
A new season of Bridgerton is here. And with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabrielle Collins, and this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Colin Bridgerton has returned from his travels abroad. Is betrothal written in the stars for the eligible bachelor? Meanwhile, the ton is reverberating with speculation of who holds Lady Whistledown's pen. We're discussing it all. I sit down with Nicola Coughlan, Luke Newton, Shonda Rhimes, and more to offer an exclusive peek behind the scenes of each episode of the new season. Watch season 3 of the Shondaland series on Netflix. Then, fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to catch a new episode every Thursday.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season 1, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season 1, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure It kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season 2 of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, Barbies. Welcome back to the show.
Perfect. Okay. So, Barbie. Opening night, we went Thursday with a bunch of friends because we thought we weren't going to get in.
That's right.
Because the whole weekend was sold out, and then they added a showtime.
Yay!
And we managed to squeeze in Thursday night.
All right. And I'm going to tell y'all, I'm a fan of Barbie. Loved Barbie. Loved playing with Barbies. Uh-huh. Had a billion Barbies. Loved them. I still have them in my parents' house. They're always asking me to come get them. Not going to do it. Their house is bigger than mine. They have more storage units. Sorry. No more storage space over there. I'll try one day, but y'all are going to hold on for now. But anyway, so I was like already sold on the Barbie movie. Like, yeah. I was like, I'm going to the Barbie movie. So I'm very happy we got to see it opening night myself.
Oh, yeah.
And it's such an interesting double feature because, you know, on one hand, you have this dark movie, historic movie with basically nothing but men in it.
Yeah.
Doing man thing, being men.
Yep.
And then you have this movie with so many women in it, and it's women being women, and they're on top of them, they're in the center of the story, and yeah. They're the center of the world, and they're the center of everything.
Yeah.
So it was very kind of interesting to see them both at the, you know, so close to one another.
Right.
And for that, especially after leaving Oppenheimer, be like, man, those ladies didn't get nothing. They should have been the Barbie movie.
Yeah.
They would have gotten more stories. Anyway, I very much enjoyed the Barbie movie.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Loved it.
Super fun. And I'll say my relationship with Barbie is limited. But not non-existent. I remember as very young, I was, I don't know, 6 years, 7 years old, something like that. Mm-hmm. And my older sisters were playing with Barbies.
Yep.
And I was younger and had my own Ken doll, except his name was George.
Oh.
I don't know why.
You named him George?
Yeah, I think like I named off-brand. I named him George.
Okay, gotcha.
I was like, this guy's name. Sure. They were like, here's a Ken. And I was like, cool, what's his name? George.
More accurate.
And so... when I wanted to play with my sisters, whom I admire and respect very much, they were like, okay, you're the neighbor and we're going to invite you over later. So you sit in your house, which is in your room, and then we'll invite you over later.
Aww.
And cut to little 6-year-old Eli sitting in my room with my George. One little George doll, just waiting.
Aww.
Waiting for that invitation, and maybe, I don't know, in my mind, it was weeks went by. It was probably 10 minutes before I was like, I don't think they're going to invite me, and getting really upset. So that's my Barbie memory.
Aw, that makes me sad.
That's how it went for me. I was more enamored with my thrift store My Little Ponies.
Ooh.
That I had with their neon colors and
hell
cool
yeah.
stuff like that. So, and of course, I had some like cool Ninja Turtles. So I had a real mishmash of toys and dolls and action figures and stuff that I played with. But
yeah,
but a little bit of Barbie. And I will say I was skeptical from the trailer, not because I thought it looked bad or I didn't like the colors or anything like that. I was thinking, I'm not sure if Greta Gerwig and Noah Baumbach know comedy skillfully enough to pull off, you know, what I feel like is looking like it's supposed to be a very funny movie. And I don't know them to have a big history with comedy. And I'll say I'm not that familiar with either of them, but just looking at their IMDb and watching the trailer, I was like, I'm nervous that a lot of these jokes are going to fall flat, despite the very cool world it looks like it takes place in. And I'll say I laughed my ass off that whole movie.
Hilarious.
It was very funny. And I was wrong to question that.
And a lot of that had to do with the performances,
sure.
I think, too. Because
absolutely.
Ryan Gosling was so funny. Like, he really brought a lot to the role.
Yeah.
I thought Margot Robbie was amazing.
Oh, my God.
Everyone's talking about Ryan Gosling, and they should. Again, he did an amazing job, and he was really, really funny. But Margot Robbie brought such a humanity.
Yeah.
She was so real. And I just loved it. I just thought she did an amazing job. I really thought she was incredible.
I feel a little badly for her right now because, and she'll be fine. But, but I feel like so many people, it's so much easier to be impressed by what Ryan Gosling was doing because his was big mm-hmm. and comedic mm-hmm. and like he has all these very stylized performance deliveries and stuff where it's quotable and standout and noticeable. And what Margot Robbie doing is so much more subtle mm-hmm. and, like you said, real and human. And you don't notice that as much. By definition, she's doing a good job because it's not sticking out.
Right.
And so now I'm like, it's the Barbie movie, which is kind of about this. And everybody's talking about Ryan Gosling.
Right.
That's upsetting to me for on her behalf. Because right. I'm like, I think honestly did a more impressive job at doing something that doesn't stick out at you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I think.
And
so
America Ferrera too, I thought was also.
Yes.
Awesome. Yeah. But I also have a little bit of America Ferrera and I also kind of have a deep passionate history together.
He has a real dog, y'all. He's got a lot of girls. I'll say Margot Robbie's in my.
On your list?
On my list. I love Margot Robbie. And
I would be jealous of you, not for you. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I wouldn't be like, how dare you? I'd be like, how dare you?
Why not me?
Why not me?
No, but yeah, I just thought, yeah, I thought everybody in it first of all, everyone in it was having a blast,
yes,
which is really fun to watch. I mean, it just makes it so much more fun to watch. I really enjoyed the idea of a land, Barbie land, completely run by Barbie. Uh-huh. The Kens are not important. They're just there, you know, to be Kens.
Yeah.
There was even like some Barbie show on, I don't even know what network, but it was some Barbie show anyway. And they show this little clip of Ken being like, well, Barbie has so many jobs and I just don't have any job. Like, what am I? What do I even do? And he goes, I'm Barbie's boyfriend. That's my job. You know, so it's like very common for Ken to be given this kind of ideal of like, that's my job. Beach. I do beach or whatever. Like, that's what I do. And I think that's really fun. And it was fun to sort of flip it on its head. Of course, that's the point, right? Is that they come to the real world and they find that women don't run the world.
Yeah.
And all the men are not himbos. Mm-hmm. Running around trying to make the women happy with them.
Right.
It's very much the opposite. And so then Ken learns about patriarchy, brings it to Barbie land mm-hmm. and changes everything in Barbie land.
Yep.
And all the Barbies are now skimpily clad, you know, serving drinks.
Yeah.
And subservient. And the Kens are all very excited about patriarchy because they get to be in charge of things and have their, instead of a dream house, they get to have a Mojo Dojo Casa house or whatever. So then they have to write the Barbie land, right? That's the movie.
Yeah.
To write Barbie land, get it back to Barbie's in charge.
Yeah.
And we did, you know, we're feminists ourselves, and we have a lot of feminist friends that are very deep in the theory, and they have been studying feminism for many, 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 many years, right?
Yeah.
So we have some friends that are kind of like, the Barbie movie, not that great, right? Feminist-wise. It's very simplistic, like baby's first feminism.
Yeah.
And it is. There's definitely, if you read any theory, a lot of the things that are said in the film you've heard 1,000 times.
Yeah.
Like America Ferrera's big speech, for example, in the film, I have heard a variation of since college.
Right.
So I was like, obviously.
Yeah.
So that can be a little off-putting, I guess, if you're watching it for feminist reasons, I guess, or if you're really
hoping
for
disappointing that it's like so basic. You were hoping for something more,
a little deeper,
challenging for yourself,
more profound, or something like that. And I totally understand that, and it's completely valid. I thought it worked though, because the whole conceit throughout is that Barbie in Barbie Land, they're being played with, right? So, for example, she doesn't walk down the stairs; she floats because you just take your Barbie and you pick her up and you put her wherever you want her to be when you play with her. So they're very much leaning into that. People are being played with. This is a playing situation.
Yeah.
So it kind of worked for me because it was simplistic and straightforward in the way that, oh no, Barbie's been taken over by the patriarchy. I know, we'll speak truth to power. And then by the time your playtime is over, everything is fixed and everything is fine. And it took very little and it wasn't hard.
Yeah.
That's playtime.
Right.
So it kind of worked for me on that level.
Yeah.
And I was like, there's a lot of people who don't read feminist theory since college that haven't heard all this shit. And it was probably still very revelatory for a lot of watchers. So I'm okay if you need a welcome mat to feminism.
Yeah.
Make it hot pink. I'm fine with that.
That's what I'm thinking, too, about America Ferrera's character. This is not a woman who necessarily has read a bunch of feminist theory and has heard all these arguments before. She's literally discovering and saying that, like, it's not that she's discovering it for the first time. She's known it and never had, like, had someone to express it to.
Yes.
And now she's in this place. She's like, hang on. Let me tell you what I think, and lays out something that may sound very foundational to someone, but she's not a scholar.
Right.
She's a mom with a job. Like, she's someone who is just, let me articulate this any way I can so that these brainwashed people can also hear it.
Right.
And be woken up a little bit. So I think by its nature, it should be kind of simple in its ideology, like a foundational understanding of it.
Mm-hmm.
It made sense to me.
Yeah, it didn't. I mean, at the time when I was watching it, I was like, all right, Greta Gerwig, I know you know more than this. This is like Twitter.
Right.
Twitter stuff.
Right.
But again, then having seen it, still really enjoyed it. I was like, fine, whatever. And then I was reading a lot of reactions and there were a lot of women older than me, younger than me, who were like, when they said that, I cried. When America Ferrera had that speech, I cried. It was so amazing to hear finally for the first time someone say that. And it was like, oh, wow, I never really thought about my life that way. Or I never really, you know, literally it was working in real time for some people that aren't familiar with that thinking.
Sure.
So that was fine with me.
Yeah.
that was fine with me. But I do get the criticism, of course.
Oh, for sure.
That was fine with me.
Sure. It's not a flawless movie and it's not going to fix all the world's problems, but hopefully it will, give people something to think about.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll say my biggest challenge was probably actually in the real world, the executives. And we talked about this a little bit, the Will Ferrell's character and all them. Like, they were so, I think Ryan George said it on pitch meeting. And he's like, all the Mattel executives who want to eat their cake, but also have their cake.
Yeah.
You know, where it was like they were
pointless.
In one aspect, they're the problem, right? Mm-hmm. Like this, all these men running this company for girls' dolls don't know no better. And they're reinforcing all these negative stereotypes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So they're kind of the bad guys. But they're presented as so dopey and silly and goofy.
Well-intentioned.
And well-intentioned and unrealistic.
Yeah.
We move from Barbie's fantasy land into the real world. And most of the men they meet in the real world are some exaggerated version of, or not so much exaggerated, of, you know, the worst kind of man you meet on the street. Catcallers and ass slappers and, you know, all these like kind of gross dudes. And then they show up at Mattel and we're back in a fantasy. Like these aren't realistic characters anymore.
They're Kens.
They're basically Kens.
They're himbos.
Yeah.
They're kind of Ken-like.
Yeah. And then when they go to Barbie Land and it's funny, but it feels unnecessary. It feels wedged in.
Yeah.
And I don't feel like they got the right lesson out of it, or at least not an effective version of whatever they were trying to do with those guys.
I agree. I felt like the Mattel executives were completely pointless, really. They really had nothing to do with anything. I think if you took them out, it wouldn't really change the movie very much.
It would not.
But, you know, also keeping in mind that this is a Mattel production.
Exactly.
Maybe baby's first feminism and goofy, fun, well-intentioned Mattel execs, where we do point out there's not enough women in here, is about as far as they were letting her go.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
So I do keep that in mind. It's not like it was Greta Gerwig was like, I'm coming after Mattel, you know, like, but they were definitely, I thought, pretty useless.
I also felt, I'll give my male perspective here for a minute.
Oh, thank God.
Finally.
Thank God.
Someone's giving it. But no, really, I think from my perspective, I really enjoyed what I felt like they were saying with this patriarchy takeover of Barbie Land, where it wasn't exclusively like men are awful and you give them a chance and they'll just all turn into the worst douchebags in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Theirs was, and this was, I think, highlighted in Barbie and Ken's conversation near the end, largely a reaction to how they'd been treated in their world up to that point.
Mm-hmm.
Like the reason the Kens went so far in the wrong direction was because they had not been allowed to have any agency of their own for so long.
Right.
Right. So they are, you know, treated as objects for Barbie to totally at their mercy, mm-hmm. and they don't really have their own full identities or anything like that. They're basically just dolls, mm-hmm. these himbos. And so when presented with like, well, you could have power, they go a little overboard with it. They go very overboard with it. And I, to me, that felt like the lesson in there is not just like these men that act like this are monsters, mm-hmm. obviously, and the cruelty they did towards Barbies is unacceptable. But also how we treat each other informs our reactions to that, right? And so there was something for Barbie to learn too. Mm-hmm. And I think that parallels back into the real world when men get all angry about how reactive feminists are, or how, like, you know, how, oh, that ideology is so extreme. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, what do you want? How, look at the lives these people have had to live for so long.
Yep.
Of course they want to move quickly and rapidly in the other direction. Mm-hmm. And maybe you might feel like that's overshooting, but what do you expect from someone who hasn't had any agency their whole lives?
Right.
You know?
Yeah. And I like too that it was patriarchy was as much of a brainwash for them.
Yes.
As it was for the Barbies.
Yeah.
Like they were fully taken in.
Yeah.
And Ken's like, as soon as I found out it wasn't about horses, I didn't really care.
I lost interest.
I thought that was so funny. Like that was so funny. And I think that's good because it shows like patriarchy was hurting them too.
Yeah.
Even when they were in charge of everything, they were like, I just missed my friend Barbie and I don't know what to do. And, you know, like they didn't like it really.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, they were pretty uncomfortable after a while, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just not how they wanted to live. They wanted to be with Barbie and have a good time with Barbie. Like that, you know, why do I need her to be over here underneath me in order to be feel like a full Ken?
Yeah.
I am Knuff or whatever.
I am Knuff.
But, you know, I thought that was well done. Or at least I thought it was a big part of that point,
right.
I think, was to show like, this is harming them as much as it's harming the Barbies. Either way, you're caught up in a way of thinking that isn't serving you.
Right.
You know, stuff like that.
Right.
So I thought that worked.
It really did.
As well.
It worked really well.
I had issues with some of the Ruth Handler stuff.
Okay.
At the end.
Okay.
So when Barbie is saying, I'm, you know, not done. Like, my story's not. And Mattel's like, well, you're in love with Ken. That's your story. And she's like, well, I'm not in love with Ken. So what's my story, right? And so then she meets Ruth Handler. And Ruth Handler's like, she says the line, mothers stand still so our daughters can look back and see how far they've come.
Mm-hmm.
Or something, paraphrasing. Something like that.
I think that's pretty much it.
And I disliked that line. I'm not a mother, so feel free to write to me and tell me why I'm wrong about this. But I did not like the idea that moms, once they have a kid, stand still and don't do anything or don't achieve anything.
Right.
Or don't continue to work on themselves or their lives because it's all about their daughter now or something. I just didn't really think that sentiment worked for me. It didn't land. That idea is why I don't want kids. Why I think a lot of people don't want kids is because of that idea. And I saw a lot of women say they loved that line and they thought it was amazing and it brought a tear to their eyes. So maybe I'm missing something. But
well, I'm sure it depends on your perspective too. I'm sure a lot of mothers feel like I put some shit down
aside,
so that, you know, my daughter could get further than I did. And,
right.
And you know, I set my career aside to raise her, whatever. I mean, the women have such a more complicated mm-hmm. Life to lead as a parent in a lot of ways, in a lot of the traditional sense.
Mm-hmm.
Like, well, I guess it's default assumption that if someone's career's got to go, it's mine.
Right.
So, you know, that's where I'm seeing, I guess, where you could find something relatable in that line. But I do think it's such a, I agree with you that it's so bluntly stated as a rule.
Right.
That it's a little disheartening.
Well, and to tie it back to Oppenheimer, is that not why Kitty was the way she was?
Yeah.
Because she had to stand still for other people and did not get to become a botanist like she wanted and not get her PhD. And I know she chose she made her choices too.
Right.
She said, I'm not going to go after this PhD. She did her thing.
Sure.
I'm not trying to take that away, but that is part of what made her so mad, I think, and feel so constrained in her life.
Right.
Was once you're a wife and mother, that's what you are.
Yeah.
You don't get to have something else.
Yeah.
So that line kind of frustrated me on that level. Again, maybe I'm missing something because I'm not a parent myself, but I had trouble with that line. And I also kind of hated the part where she's like, I want to be a real human. And she's like, well, take my hands and you'll see what it's really like to be human. So you know what it, you know, what you're getting yourself into here.
Yeah.
And then they showed nothing but good times.
Yeah.
They showed a lot of home videos of like happy birthdays and like fun Christmases and like people in a field with flowers and like babies. And, lovely imagery about how great it is to be a human being. Mm-hmm. And I remember even thinking in the movie, I wish they were showing the nuclear bomb. I mean, first of all, it would have been an amazing tie-in.
Crossover alert.
It's just like Cillian Murphy somehow. But that, it, you know, good times is not the only thing there is to being human.
Yeah.
And I think it would have made her yes a lot more definitive and powerful if she had seen a lot of bad shit, too.
Yeah.
And said, even so, with all that shit, I still want it.
Right.
I think it would have been more powerful. And so it kind of undercut it to me to only show good things.
I was 100% thinking the exact same thing during that montage.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, this is a little too nice for the idea of what it is to be human. It sucks sometimes.
Yeah.
And also, that's what makes good things good,
mm-hmm.
is bad things. If everything was just happy all the time, then where's your comparison point? What is happy? It's just normal.
Right.
Right. So I agree that I think that montage would have been a lot better with some shots from Oppenheimer. If both movies had found a way to include in their montages elements of the other, truly the greatest weekend
Kitty,
for movies.
Like a drunken dream of Kitty's where she's going, hi, Barbie. Hi, Barbie. Hi, Barbie. I'm a botanist. And then she wakes up, you know, I don't know.
Right.
I also loved the point where she said all these things about how contradictory it is to be a woman. And now we're putting all that on a doll as well, because we want Barbie to be everything, too.
Yeah,
she has to be both beautiful, slim and gorgeous so that people want to play with her. But also she has to be every job and smart and have all the capabilities of whatever, whatever.
Right.
Like, we need her to do everything and be everything.
So weird.
And now everyone's kind of feeling that way about the movie, too. They're sort of like, it's too feminist. It's not feminist enough.
Oh, my God.
You know, it's getting all the same, all the exact same contradictions that she talks about in the movie are given to the movie now. And that's very interesting to me to see that kind of being extrapolated in the real world.
You know, I've said it before many times, and I'm glad that Greta Gerwig and the Barbie cast picked up on what I was saying, which is that it's I think it's challenging for women sometimes in this world. It's complicated. Maybe even, you know, I don't know, maybe a little more complicated than men. I'm not sure.
Oh,
I don't want to lock into that. But but, you know, I'm just glad that other that women have finally caught up to what I thought.
Oh, my God. You were going to really challenging me today. no, but I think that's really interesting.
No,
and that's not to say that like movies that women do or, you know, people put a lot more on it.
Right.
I think they are putting a lot on this movie.
Yeah.
It was offering a lot. So, of course, people will put their weight of their expectations on it. And that's going to make a difference. And people are saying the same about Oppenheimer. They want Oppenheimer to do everything. I wanted it to have more with the women. You know, people were like, why didn't you include the Downwinders? There's lots of criticism 100%. For that movie, too, not doing enough or whatever.
Right.
And so we should probably examine how much we're expecting from our entertainment and our dolls and shit.
I mean, like, imagine 5 years ago, someone said, Mattel is going to produce a Barbie movie. And they didn't tell you who's directing it or anything like that. We all know what trash that movie's going to be.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to get the director of Snow Dogs to come in and do the dopiest, schlockiest, the jokes are going to be awful. It's going to be the most stereotypical, just like Minions, but they're Barbies now. Yeah. Garbage. What we got is kind of unbelievable.
I agree.
I'm sort of shocked that it was just on a surface level as thoughtful as it was, because it A, didn't have to be, and B, probably struggled just to be that.
Yeah.
So I'm impressed.
Yeah. Also, shout out to Michael Cera. Alan was a really fun character.
Yeah, Alan.
Very much enjoyed Alan.
That was a lot of fun.
I love you got to beat some ass.
Yeah.
I'm Ken's friend, and we can share clothes. or whatever. That was just really
perfect
fun.
Part for him.
Delightful.
Yeah, just really good. Simu Liu was really funny too.
Yes.
He was great. And yeah, it's just overall. Oh, and Issa Rae.
Issa Rae for president.
We're fans. Mm-hmm. She was hilarious.
I did love Everybody. Issa Rae.
And the kid was good too. I don't know who the kid was.
Kate McKinnon was great.
Kate McKinnon's, McKinnon and Greta Gerwig just found out they were roommates in college.
I know. Yeah, yep. I didn't know that.
So that's
the kid, right. America Ferrera's daughter.
America Ferrera's daughter. She was great.
We'll also say, little fun Easter egg, the daughter and her three friends are apparently based on the original Bratz dolls.
Oh, that's
so
funny.
Sort of like the next generation of Barbie or whatever. So I thought that was kind of funny.
That's
and
funny.
It's true, when you look at the four Bratz dolls, they're at least very similar, like ethnicities.
Yeah.
Like there's one black Bratz, one blonde, one, you know, whatever.
Yeah,
I was
yeah.
like, oh shit, those really are her four friends.
That's cute.
So that was really cute. A lot of little shit like that that's fun to find out about the movie, too.
Yeah, for sure.
It just makes it more fun.
So, folks, I want to know. We've been talking about Oppenheimer. We've been talking about Barbie. And I'm just curious. I want y'all to email us. I want you to message us. I want you to let us know if you like listening to us talk about movies. Because we like doing it.
Yeah.
And I've always been curious if we put that on the air, you know, what kind of interest we might garner from that.
Mm-hmm.
So Love I'm just know. Curious. I mean, it's just kind of circumstantial that we went into Oppenheimer and Diana dove deep into all this research. And now we get to talk about the movie as well. So I hope y'all enjoyed it.
Yeah, I hope so, too.
Yeah.
And all this stuff about Oppenheimer's ladies.
Oh, my God.
I was just and his kids.
Yeah.
You know, they were all of them a little bit left to the dust of history.
Yeah.
So it was cool to dust them off and kind of see what's going on.
Right. Right. Careful with that dust. Don't breathe it in.
Because
that's
it's radioactive.
Yeah, it's radioactive. thank you so much for sticking with us through this. I think I was really fascinated by everything we've been doing for the last couple hours.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you for tuning in.
Always.
Do please reach out. Give us your thoughts. Now more than ever, maybe. I just want to know what you thought of Oppenheimer, the movie, of the man, of these women.
Nuclear weapons.
Oh, yeah, sure. Tell us everything you think about disarmament.
Would you have dropped the bomb on Japan?
Oh, my God. and then let us know, if you want to join us for more movie conversations. We'd love to wrap you into that. So please shoot us an email, ridicromance@gmail.com.
We're also on Instagram. I'm at Dynamite Boom.
And I'm at Oh Great, it's Eli.
And the show is at Ridic Romance.
Thanks again, everybody, for tuning in and spending your time with us. And we can't wait to hear from you. We can't wait to give you another episode next time.
Yeah, we love you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
So long, friends, it's time to go. Thanks for listening to our show. Tell your friends, neighbors, uncles, and aunts to listen to our show, Ridiculous Romance.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
A new season of Bridgerton is here. And with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabby Collins. And this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Watch season three of the Shondaland series on Netflix. Then fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to catch a new episode every Thursday.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy.
Yeah.
Right?
Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
From iHeart Podcasts.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, everyone knew.
I'm Paul Pringle, an investigative reporter for the LA Times. Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.